Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, here at the University of Innsbruck and also online. Welcome to this panel discussion with the title The Ukraine War and Nuclear Non-Proliferation. My name is Martin Sen. I'm a professor of international relations here at the Department of Political Science, and it's my great pleasure to moderate tonight's event. The International Order for the Control of Nuclear Energy, or the so-called Nuclear Order, is at a turning point. On the one hand, we see that the political competition and also the arms dynamics between a number of states are heating up. Nuclear deterrence is becoming more complex in terms of the number of actors and in terms of the technologies involved. On the other hand, we see that the institutional framework for the control of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons is eroding slowly but steadily. Arms control between the United States and Russia is close to a collapse. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is becoming more polarized, and the conference on disarmament has been paralyzed for quite some time. A small footnote on this conference on disarmament: maybe you have heard that yesterday North Korea assumed the role of a chair of this body. So North Korea is now, for a four-week period, the chair of the conference on disarmament. So just maybe as an anecdotal footnote on the state of this field. So the war against Ukraine hits this nuclear order that is already under stress. And in tonight's event, we want to analyze the effects of this war on nuclear non-proliferation as a key pillar of this political order. And it is a great pleasure for me to welcome two distinguished experts on nuclear non-proliferation and the nuclear order as a whole. Right next to me, I would like to welcome Professor Harald Müller. He is the former director and now associate fellow of the Peace Research Center Frankfurt, and he is also supervisor of Peace Research Center Prague at Charles University. He served as co-chair of the Working Group on Peace and Conflict Research of the German Foreign Office, as vice president of the EU Consortium for Non-Proliferation, and as a member of several German delegations to the NPT review conferences. He was also a member and chair of the UN Secretary General's Advisory Board on Disarmament Matters. Professor Müller has published extensively on matters of nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament. I also want to add that on May 3rd of this year, Professor Müller was awarded the Order of Merit of the Federal Republic of Germany, the Bundesverdienstkreuz, for his engagement and achievement as peace researcher and as director of the Peace Research Institute, Frankfurt. Professor Müller, thank you very much and welcome to Innsbruck. Also on my left-hand side, I would like to welcome Dr. Michael Anderko. He is an associate professor of international relations at Erasmus University Rotterdam. Previously, he was a Max Weber Fellow at the European University Institute, a Fulbright visiting researcher at Columbia University in New York, and a junior faculty fellow at the Center of International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Dr. Anderko's work focuses on the internal politics of the nuclear non-proliferation regime and the robustness of the nuclear taboo. Professor Anderko, very much welcome to Innsbruck. It's great to have you here as well. We have structured this event as a three-step process, more or less. So first of all, we start with two opening statements by our two panelists. Then I will throw in a couple of questions, and then we will open the floor for debates and comments. Professor Müller, I would like to open the floor for you. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Martin. Very, very kind welcome. You know, sitting here is a bit surprising because I'm a very short man, as you might may have seen. But usually it doesn't show when I'm seated, but in this chair, I'm even shorter when I'm in a seat, which is an interesting experience. Anyway, in order to understand the impact of this war in Ukraine, this aggression against Ukraine, I think it's most useful to look at the various motivations which we know have driven states to acquire nuclear weapons, and see how this war may influence the working of these motivations in people. The first and foremost motivation usually is security and the defense of national sovereignty. And here we have a case where a nuclear weapon state attacks a non-nuclear weapon state, which is one of the very few non-nuclear weapon states who ever had nuclear weapons inherited from the Soviet Union, but had given back these weapons in good faith to Russia. And now this same Russia, which has received 1,300 nukes from Ukraine, invades with the obvious intention to take Ukraine apart and to annex a good part of its territory, if not the whole. So that is an event that is rather unique, and which of course makes many Ukrainians, but also people beyond Ukraine, think whether it was a wise decision to get rid of these nuclear weapons. The second motivation, status. It is very disputed whether the acquisition of nuclear weapons enhances the status of a country. Has Israel gained status through having nuclear weapons? Has Pakistan? Has North Korea? But on the other hand, people may nevertheless believe that nuclear weapons give status to a particular country. If we look at the war and the way Russia as a nuclear weapon state, Russia's status has been affected, we see two quite different answers. First of all, you had a great majority in the United Nations General Assembly condemning the attack. So far, so good. However, a quarter of the General Assembly either voted with Russia, 5 of them, or abstained, more than 40 of them. And among the abstainees were quite significant big countries like China and India. The status of Russia as a member, a permanent member of the Security Council, is not affected at all. The charter gives Russia a veto over taking away this permanency. And Russia does not even lose its seat in the G20, because too many of the developing countries in the G20 rather want to keep balanced relationship between the West and Russia. So has Russia's status suffered? Really. Third, the personality of the leader has been a factor in proliferation in a couple of cases. Leaders like to have nuclear weapons because it enhances their self-esteem, their feeling of personal power, or just the feeling, as President Trump expressed it, that their button is bigger than the button of the North Korean leader. I'm very sorry, but that was the expression, and everybody can have its his or her second thoughts about the psychology behind that. Now, it's very obvious that Vladimir Putin enjoys being the leader of a nuclear weapon state. In the last few years, he has repeatedly used nuke speak to express Russian power, and he has not hesitated to use nuclear threats in the context of this war. The worst motivation for having nuclear weapons and acquiring them is, of course, aggression and conquest of foreign territory. And here we must say that Russia appears to fare pretty well with using its nuclear status to bolster the territorial aggression it is conducting. It uses the nuclear possession as an umbrella under which the conventional operations are pursued, and it uses very explicitly its nuclear capacity against those countries who are trying to help Ukraine in order to constrain the size and importance of their assistance. You see no NATO state which would join the war in defense of the attacked state. And you see these discussions within NATO, what sort of weapons can we supply before we cross red lines of Vladimir Putin, which Mr. Putin never expressed. In my own country, Germany, this discussion is particularly lively, and our chancellor on several occasions has shown very clearly that he is afraid of the possibility of nuclear escalation and that this impacts upon his willingness to supply to Ukraine what the Ukrainians really would like to have. So blackmail, nuclear blackmail in that case, is to a certain degree working. Altogether, it seems to me that motivations to go nuclear have certainly not been undermined by the war in Ukraine, but rather bolstered and strengthened. What does this war do to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? Now, this treaty, in many ways, is a miracle, because you have some 180 states, of which at least half could have built nuclear weapons, or at least could have started nuclear weapons programs, given their financial means and their scientific basis, but haven't done so, but rather joined this treaty. The treaty is built on a very simple but also very fundamental bargain. The non-nuclear weapon states renounced nuclear weapons, and in turn they gained security knowing that their neighbors wouldn't have them as well. And by being assured by the nuclear weapon states that they would not attack them and would not use nuclear weapons against them and would come to their help once they would be attacked or would be nuked. From what I said in the beginning, you can conclude that this bargain lies completely in shambles, because what Russia has done to Ukraine is exactly what non-nuclear weapon states want to avoid by going into the NPT. And Ukraine is a faithful member of the NPT. So this bargain is destroyed. And with that, I'm afraid that the gates get slightly open for future proliferation. Another part of the NPT is the obligation of the nuclear weapon states to go towards nuclear disarmament. Now, their record in that regard was not so great. In the 50 plus years since the NPT has existed, not so great. But there were at least periods where hope built up that they would go in direction of nuclear disarmament. This period is absolutely completely over now. I don't see prospects for nuclear disarmament anywhere in sight for a decade or two decades, short of a fundamental change in Russia, as it happened in the Soviet Union when Mr. Gorbachev came to power and really changed history. For the coming review conference, just two or three sentences on it, I have seen seven NPT review conferences, five of them in the German delegation. We had never a success when the Soviet Union dash Russia and the United States were not at good relations. Now they are in a relation of hostility. There won't be any common conference management. And that's the first reason why I believe the conference will fail. The second reason is you cannot have a conference right now, the result of which would not contain at least a critical word about the Russian attack against the non-nuclear weapon state. Since Russia is a member of the conference, there cannot be a consensus document about that. Now, there could be a majority resolution, which has never happened, but it is in the rules, so one could do it. But there won't be one, because the West will not try it now in order not to be majoritized on the next occasion. That's the way the game is played. There will be a huge dissatisfaction among the non-aligned countries and some other non-nuclear weapon states about the complete lack of disarmament, the destruction of some of the treaties that have existed, and the apparent unwillingness of the nuclear weapon states, Russia at the top, to move in that direction. And for all of these reasons, I think we will have a failed conference and a further destabilization, as Martin said in the beginning, of the NPT. The third point I want to touch upon is the possible nuclear worlds and in which of these possible nuclear worlds we are likely to live. I have five types of nuclear worlds. The first and best one is a zero nuclear weapons world with stability. In other words, the perfect world. We are far from that, and it's not inside. The second would be minimum deterrence at lowest levels and the goodwill to explore further possibilities to go further in the disarmament direction. And we had an air of this in 1995 when the NPT was extended indefinitely. You had a series of arms control and disarmament treaties. You had a test ban in the making. And the optimism was really high. It's past, not the world we are living in now. The third world is stable deterrence at what I would call saturated levels. That is, every nuclear weapon state has quite a bit more than it would need for minimum deterrence, just in case. But there are some joint management tools, crisis avoidance, activities, and that's the world we had in the mid-70s, actually. It's also gone. The fourth world is multiple nuclear arms racing. We had that, indeed, in the 50s. We forget that easily. No crisis avoidance, no regulatory mechanisms, no communication arrangements, but somewhere a joint understanding that nuclear war is not a good idea. Mid-50s, also gone. But it is a world in which we are now moving, or in which we are already. We have clearly at least 4 to 5 poles in a multipolar nuclear arms race. We have the United States, we have Russia, China, and India. And India, of course, calls up immediately Pakistan, and they are racing against each other. The other three are a bit outside of this picture, but five, each of them with their own interests, each of them with a deep distrust against the others, is a situation which we really know how to handle. No precedents, no experience for that. But there is one world, the fifth one, which is even worse than that. And that is a nuclear monopoly or oligopoly in the hands of power-hungry and aggressive leaders. We are not in that. But we see power-hungry and aggressive leaders who possess nuclear weapons. Before the last US election, we had at least three of them. The US election remove for the time being one of them who may come back like a vampire out of his grave. That is a world which I never hope to see, but a world which cannot be excluded. So, am I cheering you up? At present, we are in the fourth world, and in a political environment where I believe that proliferation becomes more likely. The political environment is characterized by sharp great power rivalry. And the rivalry has, in some cases, territorial aspects, which are the most dangerous in a political rivalry between powers. We have now the danger of war felt clearly in several parts of the world, not only Ukraine. We have such a danger in East Asia, in Southeast Asia. We have it always in the Himalayas between India and Pakistan, or India and China. We have it in the Middle East, and it's growing again in the Balkans. If you go back really, really, really 15, 20 years, unthinkable, but it's a situation in which wherever you look at, you have this uneasy feeling that war could happen almost every year or every month. There is the definite fear of nuclear blackmail, which is invoked by the experience in the Ukraine. And that sort of world, danger of war, great power rivalry, fear of nuclear blackmail, is one in which proliferation motivations will thrive. I could name a few candidates, but I won't. I leave that to Mikhail. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Müller. On that note, Professor Anderko, the floor is yours, please.
Thank you very much. It's kind of difficult to follow up on this very positive and cheerful speech by my predecessor. First of all, I want to thank Dr. Zen for inviting me, and I'm also very pleased to be on panel with Professor Müller, whose work I greatly admire. And I recently published a book. You maybe have been here in October when I gave a talk on my book. And Professor Müller is the person whom I cite most frequently in the book. So it's a great honor for me to be seated next to him. I want to talk about non-proliferation and the war in Ukraine in a slightly different way. I want to start and caveat my talk by saying that we are still in early phases of the war. Unfortunately, we are not probably looking at the end of the war yet. And so whatever we say, at least whatever I say, needs to be caveated by saying that we don't know how the war is going to end. And so things may change very drastically. What we see is we find that this war actually really matters for nuclear order. This is something that like Dr. Zen said at the beginning, he started by invoking the notion of nuclear order. And if you think about nuclear order and if you think about its different parts, you actually find out that this war actually touches a lot of these elements. There is, of course, the part about nuclear disarmament and nuclear arms control, which I'm going to get to in a second, which makes it obvious that there is an obvious nuclear dimension. We have heard it through, for example, the cyber rattling from Mr. Putin, who has him and his different lieutenants have issued different threats to the West. And if you think that, for example, one of the commitments that states have made in the spirit of nuclear disarmament is to decrease the importance of nuclear weapons. And, you know, just a month before the war started, Mr. Putin actually signed a statement together with other P5 leaders that nuclear war must never be fought and cannot be won and must not be fought. This is, of course, a problematic situation. But nuclear disarmament is not the only thing where this war actually seems to matter. One of the pillars of the NPT is the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And we see in this war that there is a very important nuclear security dimension. Russian forces have shelled nuclear power plants in a nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia. They have occupied nuclear power plant in Chernobyl. The IAEA is still sort of trying to figure out how to make sure that these power plants continue to function in a manner that is actually safe, which is actually, this is a really interesting part. Because if you look at, for example, the power plant in Zaporizhia, which was shelled by Russian forces, if something went bad there, the way how the wind was flowing, actually the nuclear fallout would fly directly into Russia. So if you know, stuff happened there, Russians would have basically caused nuclear fallout on their own territory. Now, I'm pretty sure they didn't think about this at the time, but it sort of gives you this idea about the level of wanton destruction that is being inflicted upon Ukraine. The next to nuclear security, we are also seeing, of course, challenges to nuclear non-proliferation. There are people who make arguments, had Ukraine kept its nuclear weapons, then it wouldn't have had this situation. Now, I don't think that was the case. First of all, I don't think that Ukraine had a reasonable chance to keep its nuclear weapons. Even if it kept its nuclear weapons, it's kind of difficult to target an ICBM to a neighboring country. But the fact that there is this narrative that says, if only this country kept its nuclear weapons, it would have been safe, is in itself an undermining of the norm against proliferation of nuclear weapons. And so this war in different ways touches on all the elements. Now, I think I share a lot of concern that was voiced by Professor Mueller. I'm not as skeptical as him. One of the big questions that was being asked, and that is actually being quite often asked, you see this periodically in situations. You see, for example, Iraq, where its secret nuclear weapon program in the 1990s was removed by the IAEA and by the UNMOVIC. A few years later, there was an invasion, the regime was gone. And people were saying, if only Saddam Hussein kept his nuclear weapons, things would be different. Muammar Gaddafi gave up nuclear weapons, a few years was gone. And again, people were saying, if only Gaddafi kept his nuclear weapons, things would be different. Now we see that there is an invasion of Ukraine, and there are again people who say, if only Ukraine kept its nuclear weapons, things would be different. There's always these, what Benoît Pelopidas calls the oracles of doom, that are predicting that basically any non-proliferation crisis is going to lead to a cascade of proliferation. And we haven't seen it. And one of the reasons why we haven't seen it yet is because building a nuclear weapon is not an easy undertaking. It takes time, it takes money, it takes effort. While many countries have the technological and military skill, technological skill and financial mean and maybe a military need, they don't necessarily have the willingness to actually go through all the hoops. And I think even in the situation that we see now, one of the reasons why there is so much support for Ukraine coming from all over is not only because Ukraine is being attacked, but also because if we basically leave countries on their own in situation of war, then they might get second ideas about how to protect themselves. And those second ideas might be nuclear weapons. And so of course, we can discuss about different candidates and different countries that might be interested in sort of exploring some ideas for nuclear weapons. At this moment, the way how the situation stands, I don't expect that there are going to be countries that are going to start clandestine nuclear weapons programs. And I differ on that with Professor Mueller. Now, one thing that is sort of clear from this is also that more nuclear weapons are not necessarily bringing us peace, which I don't think we're going to be very terribly surprised. But we also see that even for Russia, then its nuclear deterrent its nuclear threats have not yielded what it expected to yield. Russia has issued a number of nuclear threats to many European countries. And some of the leaders are scared, like Professor Mueller mentioned in Germany, where the leadership is sort of concerned about delivering some of the weapons. But we also see it didn't prevent many Eastern European countries, Central European countries, United Kingdom, United States, from delivering really advanced weaponry to Ukraine and helping Ukraine to actually fight and defend itself. And so I think this also shows us that you often, if you studied nuclear weapons, you probably heard about something called the stability-instability paradox. How many of you have never heard about stability-instability paradox? Okay, good. So I'll explain it to you. So stability-instability paradox is a concept that was developed during the Cold War that basically said that possession of nuclear weapons creates stability between great powers on a systemic level, but it permits emergence of conflict instability on a local level, which may be sometimes very vicious and very violent, but it's not going to escalate to higher level because the superpowers are aware that any escalation to higher level would lead to basically nuclear level and annihilation. So it's basically a sort of extension of mutually assured destruction. Now, stability-instability paradox cuts both ways, as Russia is now learning. So it permits Russia to actually do a lot in Ukraine that it may not be able to do if it didn't have nuclear weapons. But it also allows others to actually help Ukraine into a large degree. And Russia is not able to stop them because it knows that it cannot, because it would risk further escalation. And so my sense here is that we are learning, this war is terrible, but it's great for learning about nuclear weapons, what's the role and the limit of the role of nuclear weapons in the 21st century. And I think we're not done with learning about this at this very moment. And with that, I would pass the floor back to Martin.
Thank you very much. Like I said before, I would have two questions for you. And then we give the floor to the audience. The first question is also something that you brought up in your statement. So I would be interested in hearing your view on who are the candidates that could play with the idea of acquiring nuclear weapons, or that could take away the lesson from Ukraine that it could pay off in the international system to have nuclear weapons. I would be interested in hearing your thoughts about this. That's the first question. A second question, also for both of you. You mentioned the IAEA and the role it's currently playing in the war in Ukraine. So my question is, do you see that the IAEA, which is by its mandate and by its nature a technological organization, do you see that it's becoming more political through this conflict, in this conflict? So let's start with Professor Müller and then with you, Professor Andeko, please.
For the first question, potential candidates. The first one that comes to mind is Turkey. Turkey has been historically, over centuries actually, the object of territorial expansion by Russia. And Russia has never renounced its interest in taking over the Dardanelles for reasons, strategic reasons, which are very, very obvious. And Turkey watches how this war is unfolding. And Turkey certainly also watches the degree to which Ukraine is helped or not helped. Turkey has a capable nuclear establishment, notably in basic nuclear research. Of course, it would take long for Turkey, but it would not be a start from zero, because Turkey at times in the past has already considered and then put back the idea to go nuclear. From the security motivation, the first candidate would probably be Poland. Poland also has a very, very solid nuclear research establishment. I have been working in the 90s with a nuclear physicist, a lady from the Polish Radiation Agency. I was extremely impressed by her capability and the quality of the institution for which she was working. Again, you would need time, but maybe even less time for Poland than for Turkey. I would also not leave out of my side Kazakhstan, a country that, like Ukraine, has turned back nuclear weapons, some 400, which were on its territory to Russia. Kazakhstan was the location of one of the two nuclear test sites by Russia with attached facilities, some of which are today used for civilian nuclear research, but could be turned back to military uses if the Kazakhs so wish. And the relationship between Kazakhstan and Russia is volatile. It's volatile. You have a strong Russian minority in Kazakhstan. You have already heard Russian politicians expressing, of course, the claim to represent these Russian Kazakh citizens. And all these things are, of course, not lost by the Kazakhs. I just leave it at that. I will not speak today about German nuclear ambitions because we don't see them. But everything is up for the future. The IAEA and politicization, it's very difficult for me to see it even more politicized as it ever was. All international organizations, to a certain degree, must be politicized because they are taking political decisions. And they have technical competences, but under the umbrella of a political institution. The IAEA has always been smartly political. And the IAEA was an organization, has been an organization with an enormous capacity for learning. The problem is, how shall the IAEA operate in any game-changing way in that war environment? I think the poor people are desperately trying to make sure that the nuclear material is secure, that radiation levels stay low, that every measure is taken to keep the danger of grand-scale radiation out of the Ukrainian nuclear plants at bay. But of course, the way the Russian military is operating, senseless in these areas. I mean, you must imagine in Chernobyl, this is still heavily radiated area, and the ground is full of radiation. And these poor recruits of the Russian army were forced to dig ditches there. Most of them will die of radiation sickness over the next 5 years. I have little doubt of that. So you cannot trust the leadership of the Russian military to behave reasonably. And the IAEA has to do a marvelous job in order to keep them faithful to the necessary levels of reason in that regard.
Thank you. And also, I think you tempted the audience to ask the German nuclear weapons question then later, I guess.
Okay, so I will answer your first question in two parts. The first one was about who are the candidates for new states with nuclear weapons. And I actually do share one of the countries that was mentioned by Harald, Professor Müller, and that's Poland. But I don't think that it's going to happen by Polish development of nuclear weapons. I think that would be a step too far, but I do think that a moment may come in the not that far future when there will be a demand for expanding NATO nuclear sharing arrangements to new countries. And Poland would be an obvious example, obvious candidate. It's a big country with excellent political relations with the United States that have gotten so much better in the last 3 months. It's a country that is going to be purchasing the most modern American fighter jets that would require fairly cheap $500 million upgrade to be able to carry the nuclear weapons. And given the relations that exist NATO currently says it has no interest to extend nuclear weapons to or to station nuclear weapons on the territory of new member states, and I believe them. But if anything were to change, I would say this might be one candidate. I think there is a number of other countries that are looking very carefully at how, especially the United States, helps Ukraine in this crisis. I'm pretty sure that people in Riyadh are looking very, very carefully at how what's happening in Ukraine. I'm pretty sure that people in Seoul are looking very carefully. I'm pretty sure that people in Tokyo are looking very carefully because they think that, you know, if similar situation were to happen in their region, they might find themselves in a similar situation like Ukraine. And when it comes to the IEA and the politicization of IEA, I find the efforts of the agency heroic, the efforts of the director general, who has actually himself a few times gone to Ukraine to actually negotiate access and discuss things on the ground. I find that remarkable. I'm afraid that sooner or later, some of the statements by Ukraine or by the agency, sorry, will be used as part of propaganda by Ukraine, by Russia. And that might necessarily lead to perceived politicization of the agency. But at this moment, I really want to just, hats off to the agency for all the efforts that it's being taken.
Thank you.